We're talking now about Tachvatat. We started Tachvatat last time, 1648-1649. The real problems behind Tachvatat are the following. As we mentioned earlier, in the beginning, in Elul probably, way back when, Poland was a monarchical republic. That sounds like a contradiction, but it was not the only monarchical republic. What it did not mean was really a republic. It means that the monarch was elected. It was an elective monarchy.
Okay?
Germany was a similar thing. An elective monarchy. Bohemia / the Czech Republic was a similar thing. The concept of elective monarchy existed, and it was not limited to the Poles. Poles did not believe in very strong central control, and as mentioned, initially they didn't have any problems with it, but now we have Russia rising as a great power, not yet a great power. Russia, before 1600 and certainly before 1550, didn't really exist as a country at all. There were small principalities. There were no major threat. And in other words, Poland's eastern border was basically secure. I mean, much, much earlier they had problems with the Mongols, but the Mongol problems are from the 1100s, 1200s. Point is that Poland ruled at this point a large part, almost the entirety of the Ukraine. The Russians felt they should rule the Ukraine. The Ukrainians hoped they could be independent. Practically speaking, knew that wasn't going to happen. I mean, that was their hope. That was the hope, the great hope of Ukrainian independence. So we have a guy, an infamous guy. Anyone know what his name is? No, the famous Russian Cossack, the Cossack of Tachvatat. Anyone heard of him? No, Khmelnytsky. You've never heard of Khmelnytsky?
I've heard of him. No.
You've heard of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. He was the instigator of the Cossack Revolution, rebellion in 1648-1649. He was hoping to achieve Ukrainian independence. He was not successful. He was successful in massing, killing a lot of Jews. Now, the classic explanation is like this. And this you'll see, if you'll ever read about it or have to read about it, you'll see this not in one place, but in a lot of places. And it's, let me first get it out before I say what I have to say about it. The classic explanation given is the following. The Polish and Lithuanian nobility used the Jews extensively as middlemen and managers for their feudal estates in the Ukraine. That's what they did. And that is basically true in a brute force, basic historical sense. That's what they did. I haven't seen this substantiated in what I mean a real way, which means, in other words, were there more Jews involved in taxing in the Ukraine than Poland? Could be. Could be not. I don't know. I didn't see someone substantiate it in a what's called a brute force method, which show how many Jews are involved and how many people are involved. I don't even know if the records exist. Could be they do. I'm not saying they don't. I'm just saying that, just because it says something in 23 places doesn't mean anything, because a lot of times they'll just copy one from another. And the way if you see a real something, something real written in a real fashion, we'll get there in a minute. You see what I'm talking. This is like historiography, as it's called. It's going to come in and out of this entire share tonight, because it's a legend, and it could be true. There was definitely a concept of horrendous and tax farming. That's not really tax farming. Selling out tax rights, the Jews definitely did a lot of it in all of Poland. People feel there is a feeling amongst historians that it was more true in the Ukraine than the rest of Poland, and I'm not sure. I didn't see from what I saw people state that is clear fact, but it did not seem substantiated via any, you know, real, you know, historical data. Okay? So that's what's stated. So it said that's what's said. It said that because there were, the Jews were involved in taxing, collecting taxing, managing estates in the Ukraine for Catholic nobility, for the Catholic nobility, then the Ukrainians who were Russian Orthodox hated the Jews. As a result of that, went and massacred the Jews. When they had the opportunity with Bogdan Khmelnytsky, they went and massacred the Jews. That's what's stated. That's straight. That's like you'll see it not in one place. You could find it in almost anything written about this period in Jewish history. They're all going to repeat this. Now, I personally find the statement. I mean, again, I want to see it substantiated. That's A. But even besides that, I find that like a certain tacit anti-Semitic. Because, you know, let's say for a moment that the Jews abused the position they were in. Let's say that's true. And it could be true. I'm not saying that's not true. Let's say that's true. Financial abuse is wrong. I'm not for financial abuse. But that doesn't excuse wholesale massacring. If you financially abuse somebody, you're not a nice person. That doesn't give them the right to pull a gun out and shoot you dead. So clearly there's no question that the Cossack massacring of Jews was not limited to that small percentage of Jews who were actually involved in managing estates and collecting taxes, because there's no question that the vast majority of Jews in these areas were not making big bucks off of managing nobility's estates, etc. So most of them were involved in a lot of them were involved in trade, but a lot of them were also involved as, you know, silversmiths, etc., 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 tailors, and all these type of things. These people were also killed just as much as the, you know, I'm not even sure just as much. They were also killed. The most famous of all the massacres was in Nimirov. Nimirov is a city in the Ukraine. I don't remember if they say the number is 2,000 or 5,000, but a lot of people were killed, including the rabbi of Nimirov, whose name was Rabbi of Nimirov. Yeah, they say 6,000. It's hard to believe 6,000 sounds. You don't understand how there were not many cities that had in Eastern Europe that were that large. And Nimirov is not like, you know, just what I think the number sounds, you know, not that. I don't know. Maybe not. Who knows? Anyway, it happened on Chaf Sivan. And Chaf Sivan was voluntarily accepted by many Jews of Polish, Russian, Ukrainian, Eastern European descent as a fast day. And even today, you can find in some Sidurim, I don't think this one's going to have it. You can find in some Sidurim, Slichas, let's see if they have it here. No, they don't. Slichas for Chaf Sivan. Usually Nusach Sfar. So I was wondering maybe this Nusach Ari, printed by Lubavitch, would have it, but it doesn't have it. I've seen it. And there are people who do it. There are usually people of, more generally speaking, of Hasidic origin.
Why would
Sfar
do that?
Nusach Sfar is Chassidus. It's not Nusach Sfar. There's Kaminak HaSfardim Ve'edut Mizrach. Those are what we call Sfardim, even though they're Lav Davka, anything to do with Spain. They're especially Ve'edut Mizrach, as mentioned. And Nusach Sfar is the Nusach instituted by Chassidic rabbis. And usually, well, that's where you'll find it. Certainly, Yekes won't say Slichas for Chaf Sivan, even though Yekes would never skip. You daven in a Yekes or so?
No.
Okay. Yekes do not skip any of the piyutim. In Washington Heights, in Kahal Agash Shishun, they don't skip anything. They say all those things we skip. They say all of them. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they say all of them. But Chaf Sivan is not for them because
the ones that most congregations omit.
The ones that says most congregations omit, in Kahal Adash Yushun, Zeminig is Trusheshen. That's what they do. They do it, and certain Chassidim do it also. Anyway, now, I once had a story just to show you how deep of an event Tachvata and Chmelnitsky is. And I don't remember how the story started, frankly. But I do remember the end of the story. For some reason or another, I mentioned Chmelnitsky. I don't remember why. And there was my mother-in-law used to have a neighbor who was, she wasn't really a Holocaust survivor. She was from Transylvania, which I think was originally part of Slovakia, absorbed by Hungary, back and forth, near the border, as they say. Because the whole Czechoslovakia is near the border. Any not grandparents from Czechoslovakia? No, okay. Anyway, so for some reason or another, she's not really a Holocaust survivor. She saw the clouds on the storm clouds on the horizon and got to England in 1938-39, before the war. But most people were not that perceptive. Anyway, so I mentioned Chmelnitsky, and this lady, her name was Mrs. Weiss. Mamish gives him such a serious curse. I was taken aback. Serious. I wouldn't mention Hitler to her because she lost most of her family to the Germans. I wouldn't mention Hitler, but Chmelnitsky, she can say about Chmelnitsky. Mm-hmm. Whew! She gives him some serious curse. I turn to her and I say to her, Mrs. Weiss, where do you think Chmelnitsky lived? This is 1992 or so. So she says, about 100 years ago. I said, no. Almost 350 years ago. She says, you sure about that? I said, yeah, I'm absolutely sure about that. Now, I usually say this story over to illustrate the difference between knowing history and feeling history. That's what you normally say the story over as an illustration of. But it also goes to show you, this is also very important, that we're about to get to historical revisionism. There's no question that Tachvata is a watershed. There's no question about that. Tachvata is, it is definitely a watershed. It is definitely a very deeply traumatic event. Modern historians, pe'echad, all agree that, unlike, it's stated here, I'll read you Hirsch Goldworm's statement in the early Achronim. The Cossack Revolt in 1648, with its attendant massacre of Jewish masses and destruction of entire Jewish communities, had left a deep impact on the course of Torah scholarship, etc., etc., etc. The yeshivas made their comeback only in the 19th century and began to flourish in Lithuania and later in Poland. Okay. It's not, modern historians absolutely think that's just wrong. They think that's completely wrong. They base themselves, now again, I haven't seen thorough, documented study, but I've seen, I may exist, in this case it may exist, they, with modern studies, believe that most Jews ran. That most Jews were killed, most Jews ran away. And the way they apparently substantiate, again, I haven't seen this in a proper written study, which I'd be interested in seeing. They feel that it seems to be based on the fact that the size of the communities pre-1648 and by 1680 seem to be about the same. If 60-80% of Polish Jewry was wiped out, then that doesn't sound that accurate. So the feeling is, and we're going to see historical examples of it, with whatever, maybe tonight, but if not, after Hanukkah. The feeling is most people ran away, but not that many people were actually killed. They're not saying no one was killed. They're saying that not nearly as many people were killed. That's what they're saying. Now, again, in a cultural sense, they're wrong. They might be right in a basic historical sense, and that the Holocaust finished off Eastern European Jew. Okay? That finished it off. And that no one's going to argue about. To say that the Tachvata was a similar event, I think that's definitely pushing it. In terms of large amounts of Jews being killed, doesn't seem like it. I mean, again, I haven't seen it substantiated proper fashion. I'll diverge and give you an example of what I mean. Okay, the 30 Years' War. You've ever heard of the 30 Years' War?
Yes.
30 Years' War. Okay, German popular history says that at least half, if not two-thirds, of Germans were killed in the 30 Years' War. Modern historians think that's not true. Now, this I have seen studies on. And how do they prove it? They prove it from tax records. They prove it because Germans like keeping records. They keep very good records. And based on, there's enough records of a large enough amount of Germany for historians to say, look, it was not 80%, 70%, even 50%. They believe it was between 20 and 30%. Now, it ranges. In other words, there were some places which were totally wiped out, up to 90%. And there were some places that grew, like Hamburg. So, but if you take Germany as a whole, the number is 20 to 30%. And again, the difference is there is extensive documentation. Germans kept good records. In Poland, you know, the Jews didn't want to pay taxes. The Poles were illiterate. So the Jews kept records, but the records weren't, what do you want me to tell you? The records weren't completely accurate. How about that? They weren't interested in paying. They paid. You know, like Poles always complain, oh, the Jews, they only claim there's, they're not paying enough taxes. Well, that's one side of the story. The other side of the story is Jews did provide, I don't remember the numbers, 30 or 40 or 50% of all tax money in Poland. So it's like, okay, maybe they were cheating on their taxes, and the Poles were cheating also. So what am I supposed to tell you? I mean, it was really a pre-modern country without extensive documentation, records, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I mean, it's hard to say these things are hard to substantiate in a absolute fashion. Now, what is true, though, again, the golden era of Polish Jewry is definitely over. In other words, Jews invited to start coming to Poland in the early 1500s. And it was a golden era of cooperation. The country of Poland was at peace. The Polish nobility and the Jews got on great. And it was, beautiful times. And that is true. In other words, the numerical statement that is the demise of Polish Jewry, and it took hundreds of years for Polish Jewry to recover, no, that's not true. I don't think that statement's true. The statement that that's the end of the golden era of Jews in Poland, yes, that's true. Because even though afterwards people basically recovered, Poland itself as a country never recovered. There was never really recovered. Poland really doesn't finish itself as being a substantial country until 1696. I think we spoke about that in the historical way back when. But maybe I'll mention it again as we go on. But it's more Poland as a country than Jewry in Poland. So anyway. It's definitely a watershed event. Now, there's one other issue here. I just want to finish off this issue. Rake up one more issue. And this is the issue of how do we understand this historical revisionism in terms of, there's historical revisionism amongst anti-Semitic Holocaust scholars, and that's been going on for some time. I actually once saw it, didn't bother reading, one of the early revisionist books on the Holocaust. Okay, because again, there's in a superficial sense, it sounds like, okay, how many Jews died? We don't know. Let's say, cultural history tells us that 50, 70, major amounts of Jews died. And again, that's what the art scrolls brings in the early Akronim. It's like just playing a clear fact. And again, modern historical research says it's not true. We also have something called, Holocaust, revisionism in the Holocaust. What's the difference between the two? Now, again, if the modern historical research here is based on real facts, then that's one difference. Now, in terms of Holocaust history, there are people who spend a lot of time. I unfortunately haven't read anything. I keep meaning to write a guy about it, because I don't know if something good's been written on it recently. One of the issues in Holocaust history is how many Jews died in the Holocaust. And we know the traditional number is?
6 million.
That's the traditional number, 6 million. Your grandparents Holocaust survivors?
My cousin's grandmother.
Okay, that's not this number. Joseph? No? Okay, I said none of us here are Holocaust, from Holocaust survivors. Okay. I don't personally, I don't know, if, I hope this is not too, I'll have to ask my morning Seder members. Morty is a family of what he calls Holocaust snobs. His mother's family is from Poland. And whatever. Anyway, I don't really think it's that important. You know, was it 5 million, 5.2 million, 5.7 million, 5.9, 6, 6.5? I don't really think it's that important. I don't think that's... If we want to measure why the Holocaust is probably the greatest crime in human history, the answer is not numbers. The answer is premeditation. That's the answer. The answer is amount of people who engaged in premeditated genocide. It's not something done in war. It's not something done against people who are really threatening you. It was premeditated, planned, and in Auschwitz's case, sanitized, not really, but enough that a person could work in Auschwitz and a German guard could work in Auschwitz and basically go home and sleep every night without a problem.
I was watching a documentary this year on the Holocaust, and they were saying how like the Nazis are normal people that are taking like pictures in the death camps. They're all smiling, you know, like eating like fruit.
Josh, that's an interesting issue, and there's a lot of there's a relatively well known book which caused an unbelievable storm called Hitler's Willing Executioners by Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. There's really two books. There's that book, and the other book is called Ordinary Men. These are two books written more or less around the same issue. Well, not all completely, but more or less around the same issue. And quotes ordinary Germans in the Holocaust. What did they think? And I'll give you a greater quote. This is an unbelievable quote. There's a guy whose name is Lawrence Ries. He wrote a book on Auschwitz. He's not Jewish, which gives him a certain advantage for the records, because non-Jews, Germans, that means, will be more comfortable telling him the truth than telling me or you. And he had it in his mind in 1990 that he should interview old Nazis. Get this. Old Nazis, people who worked in the Russian prison system after the fall of communism. And I forget who his third group was, but also people also involved in civil rights. When the Nazis were accused right after the Second World War of killing Jews, you know what they said? We were just following orders. Right? We didn't have a choice. We were just following orders. So he interviewed, one of the people he interviewed, I don't remember the guy's name, he was Goebbels. You know who Goebbels was? He was Goebbels, one of Goebbels' assistants. So he says to the guy, okay, I'd like you, I want to ask you a follow-up question. Go ask the question. If you want to sum up the Third Reich in one sentence, if you want to sum up your experiences in the Third Reich in one sentence, how would you sum it up? Okay, that was the question. You know what the answer was?
Following orders.
What?
Following orders.
No. It was like being in paradise. How's that? How's that for a statement? I told you, we're not going to get that out of them. It's like, I'll tell you another thing. You hear another story? That only a non-Jew is going to get out of another non-Jew? There's a guy whose name was Pierre Van Passen. I tell you, I mentioned Pierre Van Passen here? No?
Was he from the Netherlands?
Yes, he was. I mentioned that story? Yeah. Mentioned the story with the in Romania?
Yeah, I don't
know. Okay, story. Pierre Van Passen was talking to the Romanian foreign minister. And he asked him, what do you think about Jews in... I told this at the beginning of the year. What do you think about the Jews in Romania? So he had the day earlier been to one of the heads of the Jewish community. He told him we're very at home. He says... So the Romanian foreign minister looks at him and says, sir, are you Jewish? He said, no, I'm not Jewish. So I'll tell you the truth. The truth is we hate the Jews and we love to get rid of them. So there you go. So it's important to understand that Holocaust revisionism is an attempt to deny the greatest crime in history. And the reason why in Holocaust is a crime, the greatest crime, it doesn't matter if it was 5 million or 6 million. It doesn't matter. What matters is the amount of pre-thought, premeditated planning, going into an event which is unparalleled. Looking, experimenting, finding the best way, that's unparalleled. That's what makes the Holocaust a crime it was. Not numbers. Numbers is not the issue. Stalin killed a lot of people. And Stalin was a really tremendously evil person. So I can't be wrong. But to plan and plot, Stalin, whatever, I don't want to diverge more about that. But that's the difference between this issue and you know, Holocaust denial. There's also interestingly, I guess you could look at it this way, there's Jewish involvement. I wouldn't much call it Holocaust denial. But the Jewish side of the Holocaust issues that people get really emotional about is rescue effort. Resistance, rescue effort, etc., etc., etc. I mean, I'll give you an example. We're familiar with the issue of should the Allies have bombed the train tracks in Auschwitz?
Yes, they should have.
We've heard it. Did I speak about that?
No, you have not.
No, I didn't speak about it. Okay. People get really emotional about that issue.
But did they say they would have rebuilt it?
Doesn't matter.
That's what I say. I'm not convinced. I don't know. It's a hard question. I'm not coming to the I don't know. I didn't see. Most people. Let me just step back. Most people who write about it don't know anything about military history. That's where we're starting from. They don't understand military history at all. This is what's called an executive level decision. This is not a military issue. It's an executive level decision. Now, it is a fact, and this is. I mean, I have to double check this fact. But one of the factories in the Auschwitz area was either involved in jet fuel or ball bearings or uranium enrichment or something like that, and the Allies bombed that plenty of times. That is a fact. I mean, I'm pretty sure that fact is accurate. That would have to be double-checked, but I heard that from someone who is what I call basically who's an accurate historical historian. He's not he doesn't just make things up or see things in dubious sources and spew them out. So I basically accept what he tells me as having certain substance. Had been substantial until being disproven, but it is a very, very, it's a very emotional issue for obvious reasons. The grand finale of everything is there's no question that it was one of Germany's main war goals, and anyone who thinks that's not true is wrong. So it's like. These slew of issues. I don't see this issue being as cutting in terms of how many people die in Tal Matai. And as far as I can tell, there's not non-Jewish or Jewish anti-Semitism involved in analysis. But I would have to I'd have to do more work on it. I mean, see, in the issue of should the Allies have bombed the train tracks, that gets also down to resistance. And in modern political terms, what type of approach you should take to threats to the Jewish people? Should you take a more active role, or you should take a more passive role? That really gets down to it, and that I don't have to. It doesn't take much imagination to figure out where different people in the Israeli political spectrum are going to fall on that. It's a hard. There's no whatever. I don't want to. We diverged enough. If you're really interested, I can speak to you about it over dinner. Because it's a much more complicated issue than most people are aware of. Okay, anyway, well, let's go on. The Taz was clearly a fact. He lived in this period of Tach B'Tah. Again, he lived from 1566 to 1667, and typically the Taz ran away. That's what happened. He started out in, where was it? He started out in Krakow. He ran first to Lublin, and then he went on to Morovia, which is today part of the Czech Republic. After around 1652, he came back. He came back to Poland, to Lemberg, Lvov, and he was in Lemberg, Lvov from 1652 to the end of his life.
Wasn't there a period of time where he was just like he just went to places and just pretended he wasn't in any way special?
Not known about the Taz that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Not said about the Taz that I'm aware of. That is said about the Rebbe Reb Zusha and the Rebbe Reb Melech. It's definitely said about them. It's said about the Vilna Gaon. And not that I'm aware that it's said about the Taz. We said that was said about Reb Nassim Shapira, the Baal HaMukas. I told you that story. You were here that week.
So, yeah.
The Baal HaMukas, the Megal HaMukas, but not that I'm aware of. Okay. The Taz, of course, is most famous for his commentary on Shulchan Aruch. Now, there are four chalakim of Shulchan Aruch. Can we name the four chalakim of Shulchan Aruch?
Okay, guys.
Yoredeya.
Hold on. What was the first one?
Yoredeya.
The daily stuff.
Daily stuff. What's that one called? Arach. Hi.
Mizik.
Mizik is called what? There we go. And Nashim is called what?
I'll go with Nashim, that's fine.
And then Ezek. Four Chalakim Shulchan Aruch. Now each one of the Chalakim Shulchan Aruch has its two main commentaries. Each one.
Okay?
The Taz wrote on these three. All of his quotes rivals the here we have Taz and Mugen Avraham. Here we have Taz and Shach. Here we have Taz, Shach, and Sma. And here, Eben Ezra has Chalkas and Chogek and Beis Shmuel. It has its own world. It has none of the majors. The ones on Eben Ezra are just on Eben Ezra. Okay? So, the Taz wrote on Moshe Shulchan Aruch. He wrote important commentaries on Moshe Shulchan Aruch. There's a general difference in psak ki'ilu and minhag psak. And when we talk about the way people paskin, it doesn't mean these are not ironclad rules. These are just general rules. Generally speaking, in Lithuania and Belarus, they paskin shach over the Taz, and we're going to run over the Taz. And in Poland, Galicia, Hungary, etc., the Pasch and the Taz over the Shach. These are not ironclad rules, and anyone who's learned halacha in a serious fashion will be able to tell you that. I could tell you as a fact that if you look in one of Rav Schechter's books, the first one he printed by Rabbi Soloveitchik called Nefesh HaRav, he comments that when Rabbi Soloveitchik said Shir on Yerodeh, when he said Smicha, he used to say the Smicha Shir in the 50s and early 60s, maybe even until the mid 60s, when he said Shir on Yerodeah, he only said the Teshashach and never bothered saying the Taz, because that was the minig of Poskei Lita. Poskim from Lithuania, Poskim the Shach from the Taz. Okay. Now, the Taz, does anyone know what Taz stands for? Okay.
Something Zohar.
Turei Zav. Rose of gold. That's what Turei Zav says. Does the name Turei sound familiar?
Tur.
Tur. Like the Tur, like Arba Turin?
Or in between.
Okay. Turei Zav. It should remind you of the name Tur. There's a Turei Zav, and there's no question it was not a coincidence, as the Taz says in his introduction to Yoredeya, that he is partially and much more the Shach and the Magen Avraham. I wouldn't say they don't care about the Tur, they do care about the Tur, but it's not an agenda in their Pirushim to explain the Tur. That's not what they're trying to do. They didn't write it with a partial intent to explain what the Torah wants. Rather, they wrote a commentary on Shulchan Aruch. The Taz is very interested in the Torah. The Taz is very interested in the Torah. I didn't mention this last week. Now, as we know, the Taz was the Bach's son-in-law. Does anyone know what father-in-law is called in Yiddish? Tate is father. Father-in-law is called in Yiddish Shver. Shver.
Is that really how we got that word?
No, it's the other way around. Shver means difficult. Okay? Now, as Rav Scheinberg said, do you know why they call a father-in-law a Shver? Because a good one is hard to find. And if not, it's going to be Shver. Okay, so, for the records, the relationship between the Taz and the Bach is stormy. I mean, at least halachically. I don't know, personally, we don't have any real record. I told you guys a legend about it last week, which I'm not able to substantiate. But the reason why people say that legend is a vast majority of the times the Taz brings the Bach is because he's arguing with him. And having learned halacha in a serious fashion for a number of years, it's been a number of years since I was able to do this, unfortunately, but having learned halacha in a serious fashion, I noted that the Taz, even when he doesn't bring the Bach, usually is arguing on the Bach. And from that, I coined the phrase that the Taz's approach here was, the Shver is Shver. That is the Taz's approach. And as I mentioned, when we talked about the Levush, one of the Taz's greatest insults to the Levush is, Va'av Morechami Himen Ken. Even my Shmer got this one right. So, the Taz and the Bach, definitely in a halachic sense, are usually not on the same page. The Bach is a tremendous machadish, and he'll a lot of times argue with the Hakra, the Tour, etc., traditional things, and the Taz is much more of a traditionalist, but of course that's a slight oversimplification. Just one more thing, and then we'll call it for a night. He also wrote a sefer called Divrei David on Rashi, which should be downstairs in the Beis HaMidrash. It's on Rashi on Chumash. It's a classic, engages in all the classic things people do when they classically worry about Rashi. Where did Rashi get it from? Why does he think this is pshat? How do you solve contradictions in Rashi? That's another sefer that Taz wrote, which we have, and it's not actually nearly as used because it's not printed in the great collections. In other words, the standard collection always was Maharal, Mizrahi, Maharal, Levush, Sifsich Chachamim, and now they have the 11 major Pirushim on Rashi. For some reason or another, they didn't put the Taz there, so he's not, I don't know why they don't consider it major, but he's not there. Anyway, I'll call it here for the evening.